The big question, and this changes for everyone, is why do you buy a wine? And do you know where that wine actually comes from?
As I like to say, there's life after Cabernet Sauvignon.
The most expensive wine in the world is a Bloody Merlot. Why can't we be in that group? We can be.
It is important to adapt your rootstock to the location where you are and what you want to grow.
There's a moment in a red wine fermentation where it gets really foamy, froths up in your face, and it smells amazing. I think that's my favorite part.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 305. This week we feature Nick Goldschmidt of Goldschmidt Vineyards in Sonoma. Winery owner, winemaker, inventor, consultant, engineer, Nick Goldschmidt is the very definition of the kind of wine guy you want to hang out with. Nick makes wine in all corners of the world. He started very small and grew success with just as much intelligence as he has grown wine. The dude is a smart guy. Nick visited Milwaukee and the LBTV studio last week, and we were lucky to get a couple hours of his time on mic, on camera, and online. I'm here with Nick Goldschmidt, and Nick is the owner and winemaker and renaissance man, I think, if there ever was one, for Goldschmidt Vineyards, which of course is his winery. How you doing, Nick?
Bloody good, Ray. How are you, mate?
I'm good. Welcome to Milwaukee.
I love being here in January. Every January, this would be my destination.
Really? Why is that?
Because everyone's here, and everyone's happy to see you. I think it's because people get cabin fever or whatever because of the temperature. But you know what? It hasn't been that bad. I've been here and it's been way colder than this. And so this trip's been really fun.
I think we have 11 below coming up in about 4 or 5 days. Come back, please.
Not a problem. Not a problem at all.
Well, you're kind of a warm climate baby originally, right? I mean, you're from New Zealand.
That's a joke. Because my whole idea of getting into wine was that in the off season I would sail and ski. So I'm an extreme. I wouldn't call myself I don't like average climate, you know. I like it either really cold or really hot.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, and now you're living in an airplane more often than not, but mostly California?
Yeah, but my base is in the most beautiful city in all of the U.S., Healdsburg.
Healdsburg's wonderful.
It's just amazing. You know, 9,000 people, 38 restaurants, you know, 220 wineries with a Healdsburg address. And we're the cusp of four appellations. So Chalk Hill, Alexander Valley, Dry Creek, and Russian River all meet in Healdsburg. So it's just a wonderful place, and it's an hour, you know, just 1 hour north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and you're not, you know, comatosed with the traffic of Highway 29 driving through Napa. So, you know, the freeway is there, but we can get on and off and not destroy the town.
Yeah, not a bad thing.
Yeah. I used to live in St. Helena, but the road ran right through the middle of St. Helena. It was a pain in the neck.
Even it does that.
Buying groceries on a weekend, forget it. The traffic just, it's impossible.
Yeah. You learn the go-arounds when you can get the go-arounds, but people figured out the go-arounds now, which makes that even harder. So,
yeah.
You know, that whole area, all in general, Sonoma, Alexander Valley, which I think is wonderful, and Napa. I mean, it's certainly heaven on earth. So you're a very lucky man, other than the fact that you are traveling, as you told me, 9 months a year.
Pretty much 9 months a year. When I'm in the U.S., I try to get home for the weekends, et cetera. But, once I left the corporate world, I sort of had this really weird feeling that I wasn't going to be busy enough. And so I went back to the countries that I was working in for the large corporations and found some wineries to continue to work with. And so today I work in 6 countries and we own vineyards in 3 countries. And I really enjoy the camaraderie of winemaking and the winemakers and the viticulturists that come along with that. Because to me, wine, I don't want to say this in a negative way. It's not that wine has become boring. I think wine has become a little bit more staid than it used to be. And I think there's 2 things that drive me. Number one is exploring new areas, which would, you know, as far north as we can get or as far south as we could get. So we're looking at about the 49th parallel now. You know, going into those extremes, if we can get over to the 50th parallel, get colder and colder. And then the other area is altitude. So how high can we go? So north, south, and altitude for me are quite interesting regions to be working on. Whereas, you know, the valleys that have been easy to get to and the coastal regions have been very easy to get to. So those places have been overexplored and overaccentuated. And then the second thing is making sure that wine is culturally correct. And as a consultant, and there's sort of five of us that travel the world, we're all very good friends, but we all have different mantras. And my mantra is when I'm consulting, I stay with a winemaker, I hang out with them on the weekends and go to parties, I hang out with their kids, I eat their food, I drink their wine, and I'm not going to come in and Americanize their wine. I'm not going to pick it at 16 alcohol, 17 alcohol, because I can make Napa Cab at 16, McLaren Vale Cab at 16, Maipo Cab at 16. And you know what? You line them all up and they all taste the same.
Right.
So the important thing is when somebody gives me a glass of wine, hopefully, I can be derogatory about this later on, but hopefully I can tell what variety it is and hopefully I can tell you what region it's from. But even with lower alcohols and better acidities and cooler climates, it is difficult. It's still difficult to do that. I don't know if you saw the recent report that by 2100, the climate is going to be so much changed that we're going to have to be basically 500 kilometers north of where we are now to receive the same climate, and even further for rainfall.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I suggest we all perhaps move to Mars. You know, they just found snow and ice there, right, on the caps. I don't know why it took them so long to find it. I mean, they've been looking for years. Yeah. You'd think you'd go there first, right? Well, if we've got water, I mean, God forbid, maybe we could grow a grape.
Martian wine.
I like that.
Nothing but red.
That's good. All right. Well, I guess the first thing I do is, well, I kind of want to go back a little bit about you. You know, again, you're from New Zealand originally. Were you born into a wine family? Did that just come to you?
Not at all. I was born into, my father was a very interesting guy. I think the main thing that I got from my father was entrepreneurial. And he was part of the early expeditions to the South Pole. So he went down to the South Pole in 1958, 1959, and he was surveying the Ross Ice Shelf. So he was an engineer, and they went down with dogs in those days. Unfortunately, a number of them were killed during that time. But he instilled in me confidence to not only be an entrepreneur, but also to work for yourself. And so I was going to be an engineer. So my first degree is in civil engineering or a Bachelor of Science. And the way I got into wine was I realized that I didn't really want to be an engineer. So in New Zealand is a very interesting country. It's more socialist than we are in the US, of course. But what it comes with is free education, free medical, and free retirement. So the problem, though, at the time when I went through school was if you didn't pursue the career that the government had just paid you to do, they wanted their money back. Mm. So I ended up in this scheme. You can Google it. It's called PEP, Personal Employment Program. And the upshot was that I got positioned at a research facility at another university looking at organics. It wasn't called organics back then. It was called companion planting and double digging. And so we were growing pepinos and Jerusalem artichokes and dwarf apples and dwarf pears. We were trying to mechanize everything. But they also had a small little vineyard there. And this was in Canterbury. And now they were trying to figure out how far south to grow grapes. Now, of course, you can jump on an airplane and fly for another hour. We grow grapes a lot further south than that now. But at the time, this was new and exploratory in Marlborough. At the top of the South Island, which was 4 hours north, 5 hours north by car, hadn't even really been exploited. So we're talking about early days. And so I decided that I would stick around, and I went back and did a diploma in horticulture at Lincoln. And that's sort of what got me into grapes.
It's kind of interesting going from engineering to horticulture, but how do I put it? When you're an engineer, you have this curiosity, this idea of being able to put things together, understanding things. And I think there is some kind of a connection there because it's the same kind of curiosity in horticulture, isn't it?
Especially today, because the shortage of labor, the cost of land, the cost of planting, the cost of raw materials, just cost. So basically, we need to figure out how to mechanize effectively, efficiently, and quality focused and still achieve the same quality with fewer people, fewer hands. And we are at the cusp, I think, of developing that. And in the very early days, the first mechanical harvesters were invented in New Zealand because we had a lack of labor. Of course, I wouldn't call them machine harvesters today. They were more like thrashers. You know, they sort of bashed the hell out of the plant until the grapes fell off. Now, today, obviously, the machine harvesters today have got such huge advantages over hand picking. The biggest one in cool climate, obviously in Marlborough, is that we can send those machines out at a moment's notice and we can pick the whole of Marlborough in 5 days.
Wow.
You know, we could never do that. And so if we see a big rainstorm coming or a thunderous hail or whatever, we can quickly run out and get all those grapes off the vine and everyone can do it at the same time. The other thing too today is we can actually sort by the color of the berry and the size of the berry. So we have these, you know, in, we have these red eyes that we can like, and we just blow the berries out as they come across the destemmer, and the destemmers are actually in the machine itself as well. So the technology, just as far as machine harvesting, is incredible.
And to your point, the idea of labor shortage, you know, in a world that's growing faster and faster, there are less people who are willing to do this kind of work. Or less ability to get the people where they need to be. Let me put it that
yes.
way.
Yes. And when I talk about where I am in Chile and Moyeco, which is 12 and a half hours south of Santiago, I mean, you're in Mapuche country. It's very hard. There's no towns. There is nobody out there. So how do we ferry people in and out to even do the mundane work, you know? And obviously I'm a believer in mitigated organics that I still need labor for weed control. So how do I do that, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. Back to your path, and the labor thing has been a big issue with us over the years. We've talked about it with a lot of people because it is something everybody's facing. And I know that in Napa and Sonoma that there has been some mechanized farming done now. And there's still always going to be the issue with hillside, though, right? Or is that something you're working on? I got a feeling you might have already come up with an idea.
No, I'm facing a situation with one of my own vineyards. Firstly, if you can't plant anything really that's over 15% slope, and certainly over 30% slope, you can't get any permits to do that. The only vineyards that exist today are the ones that have been grandfathered in. This is the one big question that I have about farming is how do we mechanize hillsides? It's very difficult because you need to plant wider. So wider spacing to allow the machines to pass through, because if you can imagine, if you're on a slope, that vine is leaning over onto the path of the row. So you have to plant much wider. So the economics of planting a vineyard on a slope is much more expensive. So it costs us right now about $35,000 an acre to plant a vineyard on a hillside. To plant on the flat, you're probably talking about $25,000 to $30,000. So it's a little bit of a difference. But it depends on how many plants per acre per hectare you can get in. So let's say today, you know, we produce 4 ton an acre of Icon, let's call it Icon quality. Today in the rest of the world, we're going back in, we're doubling the plants. So that does not necessarily mean we double the volume. In fact, it's better than that. So instead of 4 ton an acre, we can get to 12 ton an acre of the same quality by planting, sorry, I'm converting from metric back to feet in my head just to make it easier for your audience. But we're planting at about 7,500 vines a hectare, so 3,500 vines an acre, whereas the standard in California is about 1,800 vines an acre. So we're, you know, more than doubling, but we can easily triple the quality, triple the tonnage and still maintain the quality because the vines are smaller. They're competing against each other for the same nutrients. And by crop control and the use of mechanization, we can make sure the berries remain smaller, so higher to skin pulp ratio, without dehydration. And dehydration is a really big issue as we go into global warming, but I don't want to get into that. So maintaining the turgor of the grape and also making the clusters more open. So we get more even ripening through the cluster. And then we come through after veraison, drop the crop to whatever level we want, and we've stopped the cell division for 7 to 12 days, and that cluster is therefore not going to fill back up to the percentage that it would be today. So I think we're actually, I know that this would be risky to say, but I think the new viticulture and planting closer, we're actually improving quality, but that's a very hard concept for people to understand.
So you're a winemaker, world traveler, engineer, scientist. You're kind of a little bit of everybody. When I said Renaissance man, I truly meant that because, you know, what you're looking to, what we're talking about is the future of the industry, is the future of something we love, which is, our listeners can't see, which is sitting right in front of us. That's something to say because that shows your passion for what you're doing.
Well, I went the, you know, the torturous route of becoming a winemaker because after I finished my diploma in horticulture, I decided that I wanted to pursue viticulture. So that was the first time I left the country. I went to Australia and went to a little town called Wagga Wagga. Wagga, the University of Charles Sturt University today, and it was built halfway between the Hunter Valley and halfway between the Yarra Valley. So the Yarra Valley's in Victoria and the Hunter Valley's in New South Wales. So they built the university in the middle there, and I did a diploma in viticulture. And that's really where my passion started because it wasn't just about the wine. It was about where we were. We were in the Riverina. Now, the Riverina's not a really fancy grape-growing area, you know. I mean, we lived there during the mouse plague, and the snakes were eating the mice inside the vines. I was dealing with a whole new culture. I was dealing with not just Australians. I was dealing with country Australians, farmers. And, you know, Australians and New Zealanders have this inbuilt rivalry from birth. And then I went back to New Zealand and was working for a very famous winery at the time. And I got sick of the winemaker coming out to tell me what to do in the vineyard. So I went back to Australia. I went to Adelaide and went to a little town called Gawler in the Barossa, which is where the University of Roseworthy was. And I did a postgraduate in oenology. So the route was rather torturous, but looking back, I'm actually glad I did the horticulture and the viticultural first and then did the oenology, whereas today most winemakers are just pure oenologists. Right. And one of my – I'm giving a talk at a famous conference coming up next week, and I'm going to show a slide. One of my photos is going to be winemakers who do not get out of their cars. So even in a particular vineyard where I consult, they built the rows wide enough so they could drive a car down the row. Yeah. So they can undo the windows and taste the grapes that way. And another photo of a famous winemaker standing under a pergola. A pergola is a big horizontal old trellis system, you know, that was around 50, 60 years ago. Beautiful shade, so the winemaker will get out because he can stand in the shade. So this is, you know, and how far we've come and yet how far we haven't come, you know. And I find it intriguing. And then, something that's a little bit controversial for me is there are sort of two sorts of wine people, or three or four, I don't care. But the main groups of winemakers for me are people like me, I hope. I mean, when I came to the US, I had $200 in a backpack, all right? I did not have a career in another industry. I did not have a wealthy partner who helped me out. And so I think there are two factions. There are the people that had the money who can buy what they want. I'm not saying buy what they want, but buy into the business. It's a glamorous business. It's a fun business. And the people are really cool. I mean, as we joked earlier, you know, the dickhead factor in the wine industry is relatively low. But maybe the dickheads are a little bit higher over on that faction. Whereas us guys with nothing, you know, but we're all friends. I mean, and it's also the only industry that I know where I can go and have lunch with a well-known winemaker from a large corporation, and I'll ask him a question on tannin manipulation, and he'll tell me what he does. There is no secrets, very few secrets.
It's a brotherhood. It is. It's that thing, and that's the fun part of what you do too, right?
I told all my children. I have five children, Ray, and I said from day one, look, I don't want another winemaker in the family. It's too hard. You guys are all clever enough to figure out what you need to do, and my kids are all science-driven for some reason. None of us can spell, but the kids are all science background. So from day one, I said, look, I don't want another winemaker in the family. It's just too hard. I mean, when I got in, you know, I did not come from a wine family. My wife and I started with nothing, and, you know, here we are today. So getting in is very, very difficult. And then one day, my number two child, a son called Luke, told my wife that he wanted to be a winemaker. He did not want to tell me that he wanted to be a winemaker. So she tells me, and I'm like, why? Why does he want to be a winemaker? And she said, it's because every day or every week I have a winemaker or a group of winemakers from another country, you know, because I spend most of my time in Chile, Argentina, New Zealand, Australia, Canada. I have these winemakers that come visit me all the time. They come and stay. And when they come, I always invite other winemakers from California or locally. In fact, some of my friends in Healdsburg are getting exhausted coming over to my house and meeting all these crazy, wacky winemakers. And my son would sit there, listen to the stories, listen to the passion. And so he wanted to get into the wine business because of that. Not because of, hey, dude, here's a Cabernet and I think this wine sucks or I think this wine is great. He didn't get into it for that. He got into it because of the people and the stories and the uniqueness. I mean, you can give me an okay glass of wine and then have the winemaker sit there and tell me why it tastes like that and where it's from and what he put into it, and suddenly it's the best wine you've ever had in your life. And this is why I'm adverse to publications of wine to some degree, because the people that are writing these articles are living in a vacuum. They don't hear the story. They don't hear where the wine's from. They sit there in this big lineup and do a competitive tasting against a bunch of theoretically same vintage, same varietal from wherever. But that's not what's important. I find it, why is it when people read a newspaper about movies, and we know we've got the Oscars coming up, which is interesting. So maybe it'll get 3 stars, maybe it'll get 5 stars. And then that person will go along to the movie theater and go, you know what, I don't agree. I think this movie is worth 5 stars, or I think this movie is worth 1 star, it's trash. And so you have an opinion about the wine, about the writer who wrote that article. But when it comes to wine, people sort of leave their brains outside and they don't create their own opinion. And that's what living in your house, living in your town, eating what you do in the weather that you're subjected to does not mean today I'm going to want the biggest, juiciest Napa Valley Cabernet. For me, with the weather like it is today, you know, it's cold here. You know what? My palate's a little bit fatigued. I'm feeling I want to drink something that's got a little bit more acidity, a little bit more CO2. I want to perk my attitude up. I want to perk my mouth up. I want to drink a Riesling or a Sauvignon Blanc would be what I'd be interested in. Maybe later on tonight, I'll drink a Cab. But here, right now, standing here with you, I'm waiting for a perk.
That's what's calling. And we're going to try some wine here in just a sec. But you bring up a couple really good points, many good points, actually. But especially this idea of doing tasting groups where people sit and talk with each other. It's all about conversation, isn't it? Wine is a conversation starter. I think people should be drinking Sauvignon Blanc in the morning. But if you really think about it, when I've got to a lot of tastings, having that in the morning, man, there's something to that.
Well, you bring up 2 points. Number one, when I'm consulting, I'll taste wines from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. You know, I'll taste close to 300 wines a day. And that's because I'm a consultant. However, when I'm doing my own blending in my own tasting room, I only taste between 10 in the morning and 12, because that's when your palate is the most energized and hungry and thirsty and sensitive. However, I also judge at 7 wine competitions per year, 3 of them in the US and the other 4 outside the US. I'm usually invited to go judge in these crazy places. And there's been a huge revolution in the way we taste, in that we always do the red wines in the morning and the white wines in the afternoon. Because your palate is more sensitive in the morning, so you're more, and the alcohols tend to be higher in red wine, so we are more sensitive to the alcohol, the acidity, the CO2, whatever it is in the red wine. And then after lunch, when your palate's fatigued, we go back and drink the whites because they're brighter, they're more cheerful, etc., and got better acidity. And that's why I prefer not to eat while I'm judging. I know it sounds nuts, but And people don't like judging with me, usually. But firstly, I'm really fast and I'm a pain in the ass and I'll pull out the newspaper if people are too slow. But I don't like to eat, so I try to eat the lunch as late as possible so that I'm not affecting my wine scoring later on. And for those that don't feel confident, I know this may be a little controversial too. For those that don't feel confident in purchasing wine, one thing you should do is perhaps find a wine competition that you like to follow. I might suggest the North Coast Wine Competition, which is the top wines out of Napa, Sonoma, and the coastal, or the LA Wine Competition, or Pacific Rim, or New World, any of these competitions. Just choose a competition and go in and look at the results. See which one's gold, silver, bronze. Because in these things, this is more of a conversation about wine. It's a group of three or four people on the panel. And at the end of the tasting, we discuss, is this wine worthy of a gold, silver, or bronze? And so it's just not one person, because one person could miss. As good as they are, you could miss that one wine in that flight because of the order that it was in. Or maybe the glass was a little bit cold. I don't know. There's always a reason why.
Sure.
And so if you follow wine competitions, which are much stronger and more important outside the U.S. than they are inside the U.S., but at least it's a group of people that are tasting, and it's not just so subjective about one person.
I like to use the word conversation, because that's what it is. That's the fun part for me about wine. I think it is for many people, but sometimes they get a little bit nervous about expressing their opinion and telling the truth. It's like, just because I liked it doesn't mean... And that's the fun thing about doing blind, because the truth comes out, and everybody's different. Now, I'd mentioned a few minutes ago we have some wine in front of us, so we should probably taste a little bit as we go.
Yeah, why not?
So what? Tell me what we have.
Well, the first wine we're going to show you is a Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough.
See, what did I tell you? Sauvignon Blanc in the morning.
Yeah, there you go. Why not?
This is on my left. Am I right?
In your case, it's this glass here.
Oh, great.
And in my case, it's this glass here, so they're out of order. But we'll suffer through. So I have a couple of vineyards in Marlborough. So Marlborough is at the top of the South Island of New Zealand. Marlborough is known for Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, and more lately Chardonnay and Pinot Gris, whatever you want to call it. The characteristic of Marlborough, or what's important about Marlborough, is there are two main soil types in Marlborough. One is formed from the Wither Hills. The Wither Hills in glacial times created these glacial valleys, and these glacial valleys are now river valleys. And so the rock in those vineyards are glacial, of course, and we call that the Brancott. Across the river, the Wairau River flows into Cloudy Bay. Across the river, we have the Ripara series of soils, and these are the river soils. So when you pick up a stone, if it's round, you're in the Ripara, and if it's jaggedy, you're in the Brancott. So it's a very simple analogy. The other thing that's really important about Marlborough is its proximity to the coast and its latitude. The latitude, the way we measure temperature, etc., during ripening of a grape is this thing called growing degree days. GDD are the number of growing degree days above 10 degrees Celsius during the period of ripening. And the growing degree days in Marlborough are about 1,800 hours. Whereas the growing degree days in Napa Valley are about 2,400 hours. So do not think that you can make a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc style in Napa or Sonoma. People go to me all the time, well, we just pick it earlier and we get more green pyrazine character. But no, that's not the case. The sun is lower in the horizon, the days are longer, and so we have the same amount of hours, close, but we don't have the heat that we get in Napa, Sonoma. So this is why Marlborough can never be repeated.
Cheers.
Salut. So this wine is the 2018 Forefathers Wax Eye. If you look at the bottle, it's a very important, it's the first wine I made with my big boy pants on in 1998. And the name Forefathers comes from a term that my wife and I came up with. I was on a plane down to Cloudy Bay going, why am I going to Cloudy Bay to make Cab, Shard, Merlot, Savvy, Riesling? I didn't talk about my past. I was a corporate winemaker for 25 years. So looking after Cloudy Bay, blending for the US, and I thought to myself, look, when you think Marlborough, you think Sauvignon Blanc. When you think Shiraz, you think McLaren Vale in Australia. When you think Malbec, Uco Valley, Argentina, and Cabernet from California. So Forefathers means the forefather appellation, or the best appellation for that variety in the New World. So that's where the name comes from. And on the label, you'll notice there's a pair of boots that I used to wear when I walked around Simi. I was a winemaker for Simi for 14 years. And faded out that you can't quite read is my constitution, which I wrote my own constitution when I became an American citizen. And stolen from the constitution, that I took John Hancock's signature and changed it to my own. And then Wax Eye is the name of the bird that eats all the grapes. And the best way to describe a Wax Eye without seeing one is, if you know the game Angry Birds, that's where the Angry Bird came from. It's a waxo.
Really? I know that.
And these things fly in flocks of 2,000 or 3,000, and they are crazy. They eat nothing but grapes. Anyway, this wine is from the Brancott. And what the Brancott gives you versus Wairau is you're going to get a little bit more flesh, a little bit more weight, and you get a bit more texture on the back of the mouth. There's two things that are really unique about this to any other Sauvignon Blanc at this price point. Number one, it's single vineyard. Most Marlborough Sauvignon Blancs are blends. And number two, I don't sell it to the British. Because the British want to drink, well, firstly, who's been to England and eaten the food that they eat in England? I mean, that's pretty boring. Yeah, it's like the saying about New Zealand, right? Best food in the world, but no one to cook it. So the Sauvignon Blanc here is a little more fleshy. It's made for the US palate. It's not made for the British that would want to have more acidity, more CO2. So this is something that you can eat, I mean, drink with seafood much easier because it's much easier for the US palate. And the US palate likes to have more fullness and ripeness. And so single vineyard, and it's a little fuller and riper.
It's wonderful taste. Great nose. Boy, the finish is just great. See, this is the point I'm making. You have that in your mouth after a little while in the morning, and it just makes you very cheery during the course of the day.
Yeah, this wine would normally be about $18 retail.
Yeah, see, that's a great wine at a good price. That's what it's all about, isn't it?
And we have another one called Boulder Bank, and Boulder Bank is a vineyard that I have in the Ripara, and that's a completely different style. It's a little bit lean, a little bit more lean. And that sells for about $15. Again, single vineyard, though.
And just for our market, are both these wines, or is this a wine available here?
Yes, they're both available.
Good. Yeah. Just wanted to get an idea of that. And this is just off the top of my head. There's not a lot of SBs that are single vineyard on the market that I'm aware of.
Correct. Those that are a lot more expensive. And the ones that are produced, there's only about four of us making single vineyard, and I make two. So I've sort of cornered them. I don't know, it wasn't deliberate. I feel, rightly or wrongly, that here I am. You know, my first vintage was 1982, and here we are now in 2018.
No, we're in 2019 now.
Sorry, 2019, yeah. I'm staying corrected. Yeah. I like blending, but I find that I can make a blend from within a vineyard. I know it's a little bit harder to understand, but by picking different parts of the vineyard at different times for different reasons, when I bring that cohesive, it's more cohesive and it's more complex and more, I get this vibrancy in it, and it's more continuous because it's the same vineyard every year. And that's, my goal is to obviously maintain the style of the wine every year, but increase the quality. And so I'm learning, even at my ripe old age here, I still find I'm learning something every year. And I find it unique.
I think that's typical of a lot of winemakers, is you think you've learned something, there's so much you don't know. I want to go back about that idea.
Yeah, because I'm not sure if I agree with that.
Well, some of us anyway.
Yeah.
Taking from the same vineyard at different times, is that a sun exposure thing? Is that because of where hillside or flatland or whatever it might be? I mean, I'm just curious for myself.
Well, I mean, eliminating all plantation factors, the age of the vine is important. Now, and so I don't really like to rip out old vineyards. I'd rather replace dead vines as I go. However, it gets to a certain point where one day you do need to replace the whole vineyard. But the big difference is soil. So even though you're on, a 2-acre vineyard, the soil varies in that 2 acres. And so I'll try to pick the more vigorous vines early and the low vigor vines later. And that was a big learning for me. I used to do it the other way around, but
it almost sounds like
I got burnt.
It's kind of one of those moments where you kind of hit yourself in the head going, ah. Oh,
yeah, it was an aha moment, especially with with Cabernet, you go out of the vineyard and a vigorous vine and you eat the berry and you're like, the tannins are dry. And then you try it again a week later and you go, no, tannins are dry. And then you go back out and it's a raisin.
Oh.
All right? So you missed it because those vines are so vigorous that they can run out of steam really quickly because they've got such a big canopy to ripen. So where do they pull any moisture from? They pull it from the cluster. So I worked with a very famous consultant for years and he taught me how to blend and then relate that back to how the vineyard should look. And through that family of blending And trying to make a complex wine, I learned my mistake. And luckily, I learned it about 15 years ago, so I managed to compensate.
All us wine lovers say thank you.
Yeah.
I want to kind of come up to today. Goldschmidt Vineyards, you're making wine both out of Sonoma and Napa for that specific label, correct?
Correct.
But you have other labels. We just talked about Forefathers. Can we just walk through some of those real quickly just to get an idea?
The countries?
Yeah. And
I don't usually talk about too much about who I work with because I think my job today is more of a sage. I know that sounds kind of weird. But what I like to do is pass on the experiences. I mean, let's face it, you know, I helped look after some of the biggest companies in the world. And because of that, they taught me. These large companies, for whatever reason, they're not bad guys, man. They taught me so much about international winemaking. When I was at CIMI, we were owned by Louis Vuitton. Louis Vuitton owned Cloudy Bay, Cape Mentelle, Ruffino in Italy, Terrazas in Argentina, Roses in Portugal. And I was exposed to this global concept of wine back then. And then we got sold to Constellation, and we were part of Icon Estates, Franciscan, Estancia, Blackstone, Ravenswood, Mount Vita. And then I finally left LVMH and went to the world's largest wine company, and I was the group winemaker for Allo Domecq, Clos du Bois, William Hill, Atlas Peak, Garry Farrell, Mumm, Bonavista, Campo Viejo, Marcos de Arenzo. Anyway, 58 wineries in 7 countries. And then we got sold to Jim Beam. That included Geyser Peak Wild Horse. And then we got sold to Constellation. I got my job back. And through this, so today I'm only a phone call away from any problem because I'm not the smartest guy in the world, and I'd be an idiot to think I was, but I know somebody who's smarter than me in each of these categories, whether it's problems with smoke taint, whether it's problems with shortages of water, or whether it's problems with new technologies for canopy minimization. I'm a phone call away from all these guys, and these large companies introduced me to these amazing people and amazing vineyards, and so I can't credit these companies enough. Whether or not I've been as successful doing it by myself is a different story. But what I can do is when I consult, it's the same thing. If a winemaker has an issue, I'm like, dude, hey, talk to this guy, man. He's like, he knows way more about it than I do. And he delves into this area all the time. But I spend 3 months a year between Chile and Argentina. So I work from the Aconcagua, which includes Casablanca, through Rapel, which is Colchagua Cachapoal, and down into Curico, Maoli, Tata, Biobío, and Mayeco. I mean, so through my clients, I cover pretty much most of the regions of Chile. And then in Argentina, there are 4 appellations. I work in 3 of them. Oh, sorry, in Mendoza, there's 4 appellations. San Rafael, the Central Valley, which is, you know, Vestalba, Luján, Lelunto, Grallo, Pedreal. I mean, the famous areas are the Central Valley, not like California. Not that Central Valley, California is bad. And then you've got the eastern region, which is where the wineries are, including Barrancas. And then we've got the Ujo Valley. You know, we've got Altamira, Vista Flores, Tunajan, and then the newer regions of La Consulta and Topangaro. So I learn a lot from these places because we are dealing with Chile is this massively long country. And by the way, best sushi in the world.
Really?
Best.
Who would have thought?
I can't, you know, there's a lot of Asian influence in the restaurants in Chile. So please get into Santiago, get out of Santiago, go visit some more. So we go from the driest desert in the world to, you know, down into Patagonia. Plus we've got the coast, plus we've got the Andes. So I've got this really, really complicated country with glacial soils and river soils and sandy soils. And then we cross over into the Andes and we've got a whole different set of problems. Over the other side of the Andes, the main problem is water and hail and uncertainty and dealing with a different variety that, you know, we have a lot of clonal differences and, you know, people think Malbec is Malbec, but no, there's Cot and there's Bonarda, which obviously gets blended, sometimes gets blended in. And just this whole uniqueness of, and then you bring in the difficulty of the culture and the, you know, I lived in Chile when Pinochet was there and I went to Argentina when the junta with my grandfather back in the 74, but living in Chile during Pinochet exposed me to the difficulties of making wine in adverse conditions. And then fortunately, I've had an amazing epiphany working up in British Columbia BC, and I'm working for a really cool outfit up, like really cool outfit up there. But the situation there is we're in a, okay, everyone thinks Canada's cold. Well, we're sitting here in Wisconsin right now. Maybe it's a relative term. But we have four amazing lakes. The Okanagan and the Osoyoos are the two big lakes, but we've got Vassar and Skar in the middle. And all these vineyards planted around these lakes, and in dramatically varying exposures. You know, everywhere in Napa, Sonoma, we want to plant facing east because east-facing sunlight is far more interesting than west because west gives you the burn. But in the Okanagan, we want to be facing west because we want the warm sites for planting board varietals, and we do the east-facing slopes for our Chardonnays and more mineral styles, Sauvignon Blanc, Rieslings. But the extreme from driving to Kelowna to Osoyoos, the big city in the north to the biggest city on the American border, it takes about 2.5 hours. That distance alone is hugely dramatically different in climate and exposure. And yet the soils are relatively similar. The soils are extremely, they call them granite, but let's face it, it's sand. But so the you need, it's almost like a hydroponic situation, which takes me back to how I make wine in the Rapara in New Zealand. Because in Rapara in New Zealand, it's a river soil. Same problem with water. We don't have any water holding capacity. And both of those regions are hydroponic. But we have different ripening. So in the Okanagan, we're a lot further north. And so the sunlight is more intense and the days are much longer. We can get a real, when I say intense, we can have much higher temperatures in the Okanagan than we would in Marlborough because Marlborough is exposed to the ocean. Okanagan is more of a continental climate with extremes in the day and cool at night. So both are hydroponic, both for different reasons, but the wine styles are night and day.
Interesting.
And it's really cool. And that's the fascinating thing about wine.
You're a really interesting guy to talk to.
You're a very lonely man.
This is fantastic. You're just fascinating to listen to. Your love of the science of it as well as the art is pretty damn cool. So I guess part of the focus of this particular trip is Goldschmidt, I'm assuming, and maybe a couple of your other labels. Normally, I always finish an interview and ask people, gee, do you have a tasting room? Does Goldschmidt have a place to go? Do you have something in Healdsburg? Or?
Yes, we do. We have a tasting room on Matheson Street. It's so Healdsburg, it's a very cool town to walk around. You can probably stagger into 10, 12 tasting rooms within, easily. You know, easily. So the tasting room that we have is Cellar of Sonoma, and it's a shared tasting room with three other wineries. And, it's brand new. We would love to have you come out there. And then our office is at 631 Healdsburg Avenue. You can feel free to pop in there, and we can set you up with a tasting down at the tasting room. And we don't necessarily pour the wines that you would see out in the market through the three-tier system. We pour a lot of really unique products that I usually only make 200 or 300 cases of, and pretty exciting. And I really value having that opportunity to have feedback from customers, consumers who are interested in wine. Hey, Nick, this wine is shit, mate. Why are you making it? You know, and versus, hey, dude, this is really interesting and unique, and why? And, you know, one of the wines that we've got in front of us is a Chardonnay, Singing Tree Chardonnay from
which
the Russian
River. Which we
should
try before we finish, yes.
It's a, I never wanted to make another Chardonnay in my life. You know, I'd been part of Simi, Clos du Bois, William Hill, Gary Farrell, Buena Vista. I mean, how many Chardonnays do I need to make in my life? And the problem today with Chardonnay, for instance, they all taste the same. And that's because we use the Dijon clones, the UCD clones, and the Espiguet clones from Italy. Because the definition of a clone is you know who your mother is. You can track everything back to one plant.
Sure.
And so the plant diversity has become very limited. And that really started when we had phylloxera in 1990 and we had to remove AXR1. However, there are some very old vineyards that still exist in the Russian River, and I've been very fortunate to find and seek out through friends of mine, of course, again, contacts that I garnered through large corporations, to find some of these old, old soils, which is called the Goldrich Sandy Loams. And these vineyards are very low in organic matter, and so the phylloxera cannot live in that soil. So these Chardonnays I'm making are from the old mass selections or old field selections, and the one that we got in front of us today comes from sea, S-E-E. Sea was a mass selection or field selection. You can't track it back to one plant. And that's what makes these wines unique. And that's why Chardonnay, for all its faults, people love Chardonnay. It's still the number one white varietal in the world, of course. And by the way, Merlot is number one red. People that don't realize that. The uniqueness of this is instead of the Dijon clones and the UCD clones, your fruit profiles are between pip fruit, apple pear, and stone fruit like white peach. When you talk about mass selections like this one, which is a C, you're going to get more subtropical fruits. You're going to get a little bit more melon, a little bit more pineapple. And then the mouthfeel is going to be more textural and more interesting. And so don't just write off Chardonnay as a category. If you don't like Chardonnay, it's probably because you've been drinking the same stuff all the time. Seek out this wine. It's called Singing Tree, Russian River. It's a single vineyard. And then we make a couple on top of that. One is a Dutton Ranch, which we've just launched into this market as well. Warren Dutton was a very old friend of mine. Unfortunately, he's passed away, but his two sons are running the business today. That one's a little bit more expensive. But the Singing Tree Chardonnay that we're drinking right here, this is going to be around about $20. And it's for a single vineyard Russian River at $20, it's pretty damn good value. And this is the 2017 we're drinking. Mm-mm-mm. Love that stuff.
That's very good. I think that's the problem sometimes. People develop their own kind of house palate, and then they're afraid to go beyond that. And I think just to your point of meeting different connections, knowing different people, talking to more friends about what they drink, what they like, is the real way to understand wine, because you'll find wine from all over the place, from all over the world, that'll knock your socks off.
I don't know how you feel about this, Ray, but when people buy, you know, you're going around to somebody's place for dinner, right? So you stop at the local bottle store and you buy a brand that's a known brand. You know, big brand, it's out there, it's, you know, available everywhere. And everybody knows how much you paid for it. You know, I find that kind of a weird concept. When I, and maybe just because I'm in the wine business, of course, I have my own slant, but when I would go into a wine shop, I'd go, dude, man, I want to experiment. This is an opportunity where I'm going to go around to someone's place. I don't have to drink the whole bottle if I don't like it. And I have an opportunity to show them to pour a wine that nobody knows what the price is. It's unique. I don't need to show off. My ego's not that big. You know, I don't need to flaunt my money or my attitude and everything. Hey, try something new. Try something different. Take a bottle of wine that no, and God damn it, if you find a bottle of wine that's at your price point and it tastes damn good, you're going to look like the hero.
That's right.
If you just show up with a big brand that everybody knows how much it costs and everybody's seen it before and it's even available at 7-Eleven, I mean, you're nuts.
I tell friends when I try something, I will pass that label along to them right away and tell them where I got it. And I say, this is what you should try. But that's the fun of searching out lesser expensive wines, Portuguese wines, wines from Uruguay, certainly Spanish wines, that area in general, but so many other areas, Australian wines, New Zealand wines. It's not having a fear to try them. And for the very same point, you don't have to finish the bottle. You know what you do with it? If you really don't like it, put the cork in it and give it to a friend. And who knows? They may like it. But, you know, the best thing about wine is exploring. Is there a web address where people could find you? You're kind of in so many different places. If they want to learn about Nick specifically.
There are many ways to get a hold of me. On Facebook, of course, Goldschmidt_Vineyards, GoldschmidT_Vineyards. Don't go to Nick Goldschmidt. You just see photos of my kids. You can get the same address for Instagram. And I post pretty much every day. Basically what I do is take photos of famous winemakers I hang out with because I'm like,
that's nobody, what I do.
Well, nobody knows who I am anymore. I mean, when I worked for large corporations, everyone would give me respect. Now I have to hang out with famous, but it's pretty funny, but I really enjoy it. And I sort of give my open opinion about, I don't usually mention the winery that I'm at, but I will take photos and videos along that way. You can get a hold of us at www.goldschmidtvineyards.com as well. That's our website. And I'm also on Instagram as well.
Yeah, you were telling me you're a big Instagram guy, and I think Instagram in the wine business is heavily used, so that's a great way to follow you.
Yeah, Instagram is really easy. And Twitter, I'm also on. But one of the places, if your audience has time, is I have a YouTube channel, Goldschmidt Vineyards as well. Goldschmidt Wine, I think it is. And I've got 50 videos there where you can see me explain specific words. What my definition of complexity is, what my definition for ripeness is, what malolactic is. And so we have a lot of followers on YouTube now, and I'm gradually putting more and more of those videos over onto that site. I just need a bit of time to do it. But I find YouTube a really cool way to communicate.
It's a great educational tool. And not only that, but to get to put a face to the name.
Yeah, you know?
Gosh, once again, welcome to snowy Milwaukee. I hope you have a great trip here. And I hope we get to meet again, because you're just an awesome guy to talk to. So thanks.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me over, man. It's awesome.
Learn more by visiting goldschmidtvineyards.com or sellersofsonoma.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shear. Copyright 2019.